Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Anne Boleyn by Marie-Louise Bruce, narrated by Gemma Dawson. Chapter 1. The Youngest Boleyn. The new baby was remarkable for three things. The opaqueness of her eyes that could never become anything but darkest brown, a large black mole on her neck, and a small deformity of the right hand where a tiny second nail grew out of one of her fingers. Later, when she had grown into a woman, it was to be magnified into a sixth finger by enemies anxious to depict her physically as well as spiritually a monster. But as she lay swaddled in her solid oak cradle beside a curtained and canopied bed in a room heavy with the odours of confinement and the scent of sweet herbs, Anne Boleyn's prospects were as good as gold. No parish records were then kept, so Anne's birth was unrecorded, but the scholar, historian and antiquary William Camden, in his History of Queen Elizabeth, published in 1615, sets it as 1507, a date which fits in with other clues we have and which is positively confirmed in a life of Jane Dormer, Duchess of Ferrier. The Duchess, a friend of Queen Mary I of England, was born in 1538, and her biographer, Henry Clifford, was for many years a member of her household, so is a trustworthy source. Like her date of birth, the place where Anne first opened her huge dark eyes has been the subject of argument and speculation. Both Blickling Hall, near Aylsham, and Rochford Hall in Essex, laying claim to the honour. It was, however, much more likely to have been Hever Castle, ornamenting with its façade, then painted in brilliant colours, the pleasant water meadows of Kent, and set in a fork of the sparkling little River Eden. Hever Castle is a misleading name, for this is no bristling fortress, but an attractive manor house first built by a prosperous Norfolk merchant, Sir Geoffrey Boleyn, mayor from 1457 to 1458 of the City of London, within already old fortified walk and a broad moat. Half a century later, it was here that his grandson, Thomas Boleyn, an ambitious courtier in his 20s, brought his wife Elizabeth across the creaking drawbridge and the dark waters of the moat, beneath the menacing portcullises and thence, suddenly, into a most unmilitary small cobbled courtyard, where leaded windows adorned timbered walls and rose-red, many-sided chimneys pointed at the passing clouds. In the dangerous, unstable life of the King's Court, Thomas Boleyn had not at the turn of the 15th century made much headway. Required by King Henry VII to be in attendance on certain ceremonial occasions, in 1501 he was present at the marriage of the 15-year-olds Prince Arthur, heir to the English throne, and Catherine of Aragon, and in 1503 he attended on Princess Margaret in her progress to Scotland as bride of King James IV. But Boleyn had no official appointment at court, and, in the early years of his marriage before Anne was born, only £50 a year with which to clothe himself in the customary velvets, satins and jewels, and to provide for his house in the country, his family and his servants, with the provisions from the home farm as well as the game from the park, without which no large Tudor residence was viable, the Boleyn household made ends meet, although Elizabeth was almost embarrassingly fruitful. "She brought me every year a child," Boleyn was to write years later in shuddering reminiscence, for the memory of that genteel poverty was to haunt him all his life. Infant mortality was at the time, however, high, and two of these children, who so strained Boleyn's slender financial resources, Henry and Thomas died early, to be commemorated by two small brass crosses, which can still be seen on the stone floors of the neighbouring churches of Hever and of Penshurst. Three children survived: George, born about 1503, Mary, about 1504, and Anne, the youngest. Hard up though they were when first married, fortunately for the Boleyns, they were also related to two powerful families, both of which claimed descent from King Edward I. Through her mother, Elizabeth, Anne was granddaughter of the Earl of Surrey, High Treasurer of England, who was to become, in 1514, Duke of Norfolk, head of the Howards. Though temporarily also short of money, through having found themselves on the Plantagenet side at the end of the Wars of the Roses, the Howards had soon regained their influence at court. Through her father, Anne was the great-granddaughter of the rich Earl of Ormond, possessor of the major areas of Tipperary and Kilkenny, as well as 72 manors in England. Ormond would live until 1515, but his son-in-law William was less lucky. He died in 1505, leaving Thomas Boleyn 8 manors. So by Anne's birth date, 2 years later, the shadow of genteel poverty had already lifted from the stone towers and raftered rooms of Hever Castle, and by the time Anne was toddling about the rush-strewn floors of her nursery and reaching up to the scented herbs on the windowsills, Thomas's career had taken a dramatic step forward too. The ageing King Henry VII had appointed him to that much-coveted position among the lesser courtiers, Esquire to the Body, a position which had the clear advantage of giving access to the monarch in days when he was the chief source of wealth and power, of preferment and perquisites. Thomas Boleyn, as one of Henry's 6 esquires, slept on a pallet within call, personally dressed the king in the royal bedchamber, with garments handed to him on the threshold by a groom who was forbidden to enter, and who, in his turn, had received the sacred garment from the yeoman of the wardrobe at the door of the privy chamber. When in 1509 the old King Henry VII died, to be replaced by his athletic 17-year-old son as Henry VIII, Boleyn, at the age of 32, somehow hung on to his position in the royal household. Its new master, who before Prince Arthur's death had been intended for the church and spent his childhood secluded from the world, lived in apartments whose only door opened out of his father's rooms, forbidden to speak to any but specially selected people, and allowed to walk only in the royal park, now emerged from this cocoon-like existence into the sudden brilliance and freedom of life as a king. He was suggestible and easily flattered. Boleyn made profitable use of these failings in the monarch's character. The young Henry, reacting against his upbringing, ushered in his spectacular reign by executing his father's 2 tax collectors, Empsom and Dudley, then squandering the carefully hoarded money. He turned the sober court of his parsimonious father into a gorgeous display of colour and gaiety and music. He masked and danced to the sound of lute, fife and tabor, built great tilt-yards, adorned them with stands and tiny towers for the audience, and himself thundered down the lists where, emblazoned with some cryptic message of love, he jousted for his lady's favour like the knights in the old romances. Boleyn forced himself to take part in these simple entertainments, to dress up in the exotic disguise of a Moor or a Muscovite, and revel in the palace banqueting rooms, to risk being swept from his horse in the tilt-yard by the lance and superior weight of the king, 6 feet 2 inches tall, with massive shoulders and limbs, and an aggressive spirit to match. Boleyn was a man with ambition, few scruples, more than average intelligence, and the foresight to become a fluent speaker of French, a rare attainment among his contemporaries at court. Henry was quick to recognize the usefulness of such a servant. As Anne grew from toddler to little girl, dressed in the clothes of a miniature adult, consisting of a smock or shirt, the only undergarment worn, stockings with garters, petticoats and long gown, her father rose steadily in the royal favour. He was created Knight of the Bath at the coronation, Keeper of the Exchange at Calais, and of the Foreign Exchange in England 3 months later. In 1511, he became Sheriff of Kent, in 1512, Joint Constable of Norwich Castle. That same year, he was appointed Ambassador to the Emperor Maximilian, and the following year, Ambassador to Margaret of Savoy, Archduchess of Austria and Regent of the Netherlands. Boleyn's embassy to Margaret was to have important repercussions on the lives of both Anne and her elder sister Mary. By this time, her father was well able to afford a larger household than Hever, but a larger household meant more servants, more beef, mutton and ale, more costly hangings and tapestries for the walls, more expense. Boleyn, like Henry VII, did not enjoy expense, and so at Hever the family remained, moving to another manor only when it was strictly necessary to have the house cleaned for fear of the plague, that dreaded summer visitor known in England because of its most obvious symptom as the sweat. From what we know of Anne in later life, we can imagine her at the age of 6, a black-haired, black-eyed child with a terrible temper, a gift for wild infectious gaiety and a corresponding moodiness. Like all children of her class, she would have been cared for mainly by servants, her mother, Lady Elizabeth Boleyn, being too busy managing the household and farm to give her much attention. Nevertheless, an affectionate, warm relationship did grow up between Anne and her mother. Elizabeth Boleyn, eldest daughter of the Earl of Surrey by his first marriage, is a somewhat shadowy woman, about whom history tells us far too little. She must have possessed some of the sexual magnetism and gaiety of her daughters, for her sole claim to personal notice rests on a scandalous tale about her relationship with the young King Henry VIII, a scandal that became current years later, repeated by Catholic writers in the hope of discrediting Anne. She was Henry's daughter by her mother. It was an implausible tale, which Henry furiously denied. Apart from this one unhappy venture into the limelight of history, Elizabeth retires once more into oblivion, never again achieving notice or position on her own account at court. Often there, in later years, she is rarely mentioned. Alone among the Boleyn family, she is responsible neither for explosively provocative comments nor for love dramas, an apparently gentle, self-effacing woman whose influence on her children paled beside her husband's. And despite Anne's affection for her mother, it was her father's ambitious, thrusting nature that was to drive her throughout her life. Anne's father's character is plain for all to see in the coloured drawing by Holbein. In the expensive but tasteless clothes, the huge, slashed sleeves, the fashionable velvet cap aslant his bobbed hair, Boleyn is an impressive figure, broad-shouldered, bull-necked with strong features, dark hair and reddish beard, a handsome man. There is yet a terrible, neurotic fixation about Boleyn's face, a flatness of the blue eyes, a lack of warmth in the unsmiling mouth. Boleyn's dominant emotion was avarice, a characteristic he was to hand down to his most famous descendant, the future Queen Elizabeth. His love for his children was closely involved with their chances of worldly success, for which he laid careful plans, paying particular attention to the education of his daughters. Girls and boys of royal birth in the 16th century were given the same rigorous intellectual education, but the lowlier daughters of the English aristocracy, like Anne, were taught little beyond basic reading, writing, and the social accomplishments of the day. To learn these, a girl was normally sent away at the age of about 7 to live in the house of some great noblewoman, where she would learn to ride side saddle, to hawk and to hunt, chasing hares with her own hound, shooting deer with a bow and arrow while standing on a specially made platform in the deer park. She would learn to sing, dance, and play the lute, and, most important of all, to conform to the laws of courtesy, that mixture of etiquette, good manners, and chivalry that was considered the cornerstone of a 16th-century noblewoman's upbringing. This included how to kneel when speaking to royalty, and how to conduct herself at the complicated ceremony of dinner, the main meal of the day, which took place at mid-morning in the great hall, where the whole household gathered, the lord and his guests sitting at a table on the dais, looking down on those of humbler degree. The daily ritual involved many points of deportment. The young girl would be taught how to sit up straight at a trestle table on a wooden form, for chairs were reserved only for most important people, how to wash her hands in a ewer before and after the meal, how to cope at a sitting with 20 different dishes, which in a nobleman's household was the average number and consisted of a much wider variety of meat and fish than is eaten today, anything from peacocks or swans to porpoise and peas. Many different dishes were served at a course, each course being announced by a fanfare of trumpets and brought in solemn procession by the household officials. She would learn how to eat delicately and efficiently with knife and fingers, for forks were not generally used in England until the reign of James I, how to take salt with her knife instead of dipping her food in the big communal salt cellar as the common people did. And she would herself take her turn carving for and waiting on the noblewomen in whose care she had been placed. All these things Anne and Mary had, of course, to learn, but they must learn more. Boleyn sought for them not so much an intellectual education as that extra polish and breadth that would attract attention at court and help them to make advantageous marriages. For though most of these were arranged, there was still a small leeway for attraction. A daughter who married well could benefit her father by providing useful connections, and the fortunes of the Boleyns, only 3 generations ago an obscure Norfolk family, were virtually founded on a succession of brilliant marriages. Anne's great-grandfather, Geoffrey Boleyn, the silk and wool merchant who rose to be Mayor of London, had also contrived to marry the heiress daughter of Lord Hu. Anne's grandfather, William Boleyn, married Margaret, younger daughter of the Earl of Ormond, and Anne's father had continued the family tradition by marrying a member of the illustrious Howard family. Boleyn ambitiously decided to have his daughters educated, not in the horsey, hearty atmosphere of some large country manor, but at court, not in England, but abroad, where new forms of art, new ideas were more quickly accepted, and the Renaissance was already in full bloom. Thomas Boleyn's embassy of 1513 brought him the acquaintance of Margaret, Archduchess of Austria, regent of the Netherlands. The Archduchess accepted his proposal that his elder daughter should come to her as maid of honour, and Mary, a pretty, engaging, precocious little girl, was duly packed off to court at Brussels, where Margaret was delighted with her. Enthusiastically she wrote, "I have received your letter by the Esquire Bouton, who presented to me your daughter, who was very welcome to me, and I hope to treat her in such a fashion that you will have reason to be content with it. At least be sure that, until your return, there need be no other intermediary between you and me than she, and I find her of such good address and so pleasing in her youthful age that I am more beholden to you for having sent her to me than you are to me." Encouraging indeed was the success of Boleyn's first attempt at launching a daughter into a foreign court. It tempted him to be even more ambitious. If Mary was such a success at 10, why not Anne at 7? And why should they not both be brought up in fashionable France? In 1514, the betrothal of Henry VIII's sister, the gay and beautiful 18-year-old Princess Mary, to the old and ailing Louis XII of France, gave Boleyn the opportunity he wanted. He dispatched an escort to Brussels with a letter for the Archduchess. "My very dear and renowned lady, I recommend myself as humbly as possible to your good graces." He went on to say that the king's sister, Princess Mary, had requested the company of his daughter on her approaching trip to France, and to ask Margaret, very humbly again, to release her. This the Archduchess did, and Mary became one of the Queen's women in the distinguished company of the two sisters of the Marquess of Dorset, the sister of Lord Grey and the daughter of Lord Dacre, a group of young girls, all under the supervision of Lady Guildford. Boleyn arranged for Anne to accompany them, although she was too young to have any official position. In the stormy autumn of 1514, 7-year-old Anne, a miniature lady on horseback with her father and her elder sister, joined the gorgeous cavalcade that rode in damasks and satins, in velvets and gold chains from the court to Dover, led by the king and his short, smiling, visibly pregnant Spanish queen. All the chief courtiers travelled down to see the princess safely launched on the grey seas for France. It was probably Anne's first sight of the king, now 23, and according to Piero Pasqualigo, the ambassador extraordinary from Venice, a paragon of manly beauty and accomplishment, "His Majesty is the handsomest potentate I have ever set eyes upon, above the usual height with an extremely fine calf to his leg, his complexion very fair and bright, with auburn hair combed straight and short in the French fashion, and a round face so very beautiful that it would become a pretty woman, his throat being rather long and thick. He speaks French, English and Latin, and a little Italian, plays well on the lute and harpsichord, sings from the book at sight, draws the bow with greater strength than any man in England, and jousts marvellously." To the Boleyn children, whose father's career depended on him, this young Henry VIII must have been a dazzling figure indeed. But in the 16th century, even so splendid and powerful a creature as the King of England had to defer to wind and weather when it came to crossing the Channel. On reaching Dover, they found the sea so wild they had to wait several days in the castle before it was safe to load the princess's horses, dowry and wardrobe on board, for the princess and her numerous escort, including Boleyn, to embark, and for the little fleet to cast anchor. In the small hours of the morning of 2nd October 1514, vaguely resplendent in the flickering torchlight, the young king came gallantly down to the harbour to kiss his favourite sister and wish her godspeed. At 4 o'clock, the dark water was calm, the ships set sail. But before they had gone a quarter of the way, the wind suddenly rose again and scattered the vessels, some ships making for Flanders, some for Calais, and the princesses for Boulogne, where the captain ran aground before they reached harbour and the terrified passengers had to take to the boats. Sir Christopher Garnish, a gentleman of great presence of mind and considerable strength, gallantly ran into the water, picked up the princess and carried her in his arms to dry land. But lesser ladies, and the Boleyn children, had to rely on tiny French rowboats to convey them to shore, where the official reception awaited. In Boulogne, The royal company rested to recover from their experience before riding on by easy stages to Abbeville, where 7-year-old Anne had a foretaste of the pomp and triumph of a royal wedding. Through the gates in the ramparts of this ancient town, Princess Mary, future Queen of France, made a magnificent ceremonial entry. The graceful princess, in cloth of silver, rode a horse caparisoned in gold, and was followed by a train of 36 ladies, which almost certainly included the 2 Boleyn children. The ladies rode palfreys caparisoned in embroidered crimson velvet, a colour that would have contrasted well with Anne's dark hair and eyes. They were followed by 3 chariots, one covered in cloth of tissue, the second in cloth of gold, and the third in crimson velvet, embroidered with the arms of the French king and the English princess, and full of roses. After those came companies of archers, then wagons laden with plate, jewels, money, apparel, and wall hangings. The next day, in the high-vaulted space and rainbow light of the newly built church, Anne saw the impressive medieval service of the king's marriage to the princess, both clothed all in gold, heard the chanting of the choristers, the sonorous Latin plainsong. But immediately, after the wedding, the prematurely senile, jealous Louis rudely dismissed all his wife's more experienced ladies, including Lady Guildford, leaving the princess with no one to attend on her but a group of young girls, among whom were Mary and Anne. It was a doleful situation, but not one to last long. Princess Mary plunged the court into an orgy of gaiety, feasts and dances that wrought havoc with King Louis's already failing health. Less than 3 months after the wedding in the great church of Abbeville, King Louis died, leaving the widowed queen to be closely confined, according to custom, for 6 weeks in the Hôtel de Cluny, a measure at least as practical as it was sentimental, since 6 weeks would show whether or not a posthumous heir to the throne was on the way. None was. The mourning period over, the King of England sent the Duke of Suffolk to bring his sister home again. It was the beginning of a love drama as exciting as any in Malory's recently printed Mort d'Arthur, the popular literature of the day. Henry Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, short-sighted and in his 30s, had risen to power largely through physical attributes. The son of King Henry VII's standard-bearer, he was a man of no particular intelligence, but superb looks, as tall and almost as broad as the king, with dense black hair and beard, a marvellous strength and vitality. He was a huge, hearty extrovert, and just the companion the king needed for his rumbustious revels and athletic pursuits. He had received his dukedom in 1514 and had been christened the king's alter ego by a Venetian ambassador. He was also irresistible to women. Princess Mary had set her heart on him before her wedding to Louis and had extracted from her brother Henry a promise. If Louis should die, she might be allowed to choose her own next husband. But Mary Tudor knew her brother too well to trust him to keep it. Loath to become the victim of another dynastic marriage, Princess Mary, with a Tudor determination that belied her rose-like appearance, forced the nervous Suffolk to marry her secretly in France before returning to face her brother's wrath in England and eventually to receive his forgiveness. Mary Tudor's example was to give Anne altogether the wrong idea about King Henry's clemency in matters of love. That Princess Mary, or the French Queen as she was henceforth known, had returned to England did not distract Boleyn from his purpose. In France, the Boleyn children remained. Exactly where is uncertain. Anne, according to one theory, stayed for some time in the household of a nobleman friend of her father's near Paris, in the tiny village of Brie-sous-Forge, while Boleyn persisted doggedly in his determined efforts to find a new place for his daughters at the French court. He managed to find one for Mary. Finally, he wrote triumphantly to tell Anne that he had been successful in placing her too. She was to become one of the select group of girls under the patronage of Claude, Queen of King Louis's 20-year-old successor, the elegant, long-nosed, sensual, witty King Francis.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?